Usually when I do these presentations, I have the clicker, so I get to make the decision about when to start. Oh, here we go. I'm going to repeat my name for the tape in case they didn't catch it before. My name is Joy Vino. I'm with Midwest Christian Outreach from the Chicago area, and the name of this presentation is Culture Wars. The reason I put this up here is, and said, of course, doesn't this look like fun, is because it really doesn't look like much fun to me. Intellectually, I'm not a pacifist. I think there's times when war might be necessary. I have extreme gratitude for the freedom that we had from people that have gone and fought. I think of Saving Private Ryan, that movie, and what they went through charging up that beach, and it sort of gives me a chill. You know, I can't imagine giving up my life or my health, you know, for other people. I'm a little bit of a coward. So, but intellectually, I'm not a pacifist, but emotionally, I am. That would be very hard for me to do, to kill somebody or to, you know, I don't even like roadkill. I'm one of these people that if I see a little dog or a little animal dead by the side of the road, I really don't like it. So war is definitely not something that I want to do. But in the culture wars, we're not talking physical warfare, but in the culture wars, we can't really avoid it because it's coming to get us. I mean, we can try to sort of stay in the background. We're in a counter-cult ministry, so we deal with people that get themselves caught up in cults like Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons or different groups. And, you know, most people can avoid that kind of contact. If somebody comes to the door, they can just hide or shut the door. Or, you know, most people can avoid meeting people that are with UFO cults and what have you. You know, you can avoid that. The culture wars, we cannot avoid. We cannot really avoid. We're finding out. And we're also given the mandate to defend the faith and to defend what is right. So we really should not be avoiding these kind of confrontations. In any case. And this is what this conference has been all about, tolerance. So I don't have to say too much about it. Tolerance, police. But I do want to bring in one point, and that is that the opening salvo of the tolerance thing was tolerance used to mean, you know, back in the old days, you could look it up, and it meant that you would disagree with someone civilly or agreeably. You would allow them to differ with you without trying to harm them in some way. But then the opening salvo of changing that was to say there is no truth, kind of the relative truth thing. You have your truth, I have my truth, and there is no ultimate truth in that kind of thinking. And this is what's been talked about during this whole conference. But I would like to suggest that now it has come full circle and there is a truth again. Out there in culture, there is a truth again, and it's the liberal truth. And if you do not agree with the liberal truth, then you are, you know, bad, evil, hateful, whatever. But there is truth again. That's what is so interesting. First, they started off by saying there was no truth. An example of that, this is from your Denver Rocky Mountain News Saturday's paper, February 19th, 2000. And the heading is, Hate State No More, Gay Groups Say. Colorado more tolerant than when Amendment 2 was passed, rights activists say. I'm just going to read one little part of it down here. It says, more representative of the growing tolerance in Colorado was the large number of elected officials, clergy members, and private citizens who spoke against same-sex marriage ban, says Lori Gervan of Equality Colorado. So what are they saying? They're saying that these people are tolerant because they have capitulated. They have capitulated to the truth, the liberal truth that is assumed to be true, that there should be same-sex marriage. So, okay.
What's right and what's not right? I think that's what this whole thing is about. I can't impose my values on someone else. That's right for them, right there. That's right.
Okay, this is that was a gay activist, whatever. I'm not even sure what it was. Get together. And you heard what they said. There is no truth, though. Who's to say what's right and what's wrong? That's sort of illustrating the first part of the equation. You want to change that? But yet, you can see the tolerance crowd does not tolerate Christians. The religious right is wrong. Now, we just heard them say there is no right and wrong, and now they're saying the Christian right is wrong. So this little guy's going, huh? What do you mean? I thought you said there was no right and wrong. It's not just Christians that the tolerance crowd can't tolerate. Actually, the tolerance crowd can't tolerate anyone that would take a stand on cultural, moral right and wrong. Okay, so that's that one. And this slide kind of shows where how it's come full circle. And as you can see, these people are not tolerant. They're very angry. They're angry over different things. On the top, phobia killed again. They're angry about Matthew Shepard, who was a young homosexual man who was viciously murdered. I don't blame them for being mad. I'm mad. I am mad that someone would harm another person like that. I'm mad for anyone that would get hurt that way or viciously murdered. But my opinion is, what I'm sharing with you is, they're mad at the wrong people. They're mad at Christians who did nothing to them. You know, it wasn't Christians that went and did that to that boy, but they are blaming us simply because we believe that there should be a ban on same-sex marriages, etc. The next, the civil rights or civil... Oops, he took it off a little too soon. Civil rights or civil war, they're angry because they would like to have the right to marry. Well, there's a lot of people that don't have the right to marry. We still... people are not allowed to marry their sister, their mother, their brother, their cousin. They're not allowed to marry an animal. They're not allowed to marry two people at once, you know. And so it is not, it's just saying a man and a woman is marriage. And yet what they're really wanting is special rights, in my opinion. And then this other one is, you know, they're mad and AIDS cure now and what have you. Well, I'd like to know who's responsible for AIDS. I mean, who, what did we do? You know, who can fix it? You know, it's going to take time, it's going to take money, and I don't see us getting angry if people makes for a cure any sooner. Okay, what are we fighting about anyway? Homosexuality, abortion, euthanasia. Of course, there's other issues too. There's radical feminism. I would find myself at war with any culture that demonizes men. You know, I have a father, I have brothers, I have male friends. To me, it's totally wrong the way that they've demonized men in this culture. You can go into any store, you could never find, say you go to Hallmark store, you could find a card that would make fun of men. You would never be able to find that about any other group. It's like they're the last people that, you know, it's free shooting on them, free shooting on men. But when I do say that we're at war, that we're fighting, I don't mean that we are physically fighting or that we hate anyone or that we want to hurt anyone. We, as Christians, are called to love people. And the Bible says that we're not at war with people. We're at war with principalities and powers, which would be demonic forces, and we're also at war with false ideas. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is some of these false arguments or false ideas. Now, these are the arguments that the homosexual activists will give. You want to just put them up there? 10% of the population is homosexual. Second, God made me this way. Scientific studies have proven that sexual orientation is a matter of genetics. Third, homosexuals cannot change their orientation. And fourth, homosexuals are an oppressed minority that needs special protection. And you've probably heard these arguments. They're very, very common. So we're just going to talk about them one at a time. This is 10% of the population is homosexual, and yet they did a study, a 1992 French study, found that only 4% of men and 3% of women reported same-sex contact in their entire lifetime. That would be at any point in their life. Only 4% and 3%. And only 1.4% of men and 0.4% of women said that any had occurred in the previous 5 years. So we are talking a much smaller figure than the 10% that they have touted for years.
The thing about the 1 in 10, I think people probably always did know that it was inflated, but it was a nice number that you could point to, that you could say 1 in 10, and it's a really good way to get people to visualize that we're here.
This is a very common leftist ploy. You know, truth doesn't matter. What does matter is that we get our agenda across. And you can see that demonstrated right there. That's also been demonstrated later on, we'll see, with the abortion arguments. God made me this way. Scientific studies have proven that sexual orientation is a matter of genetics. Activists point to a 1991 study of identical twins by Dr. J. Michael Bailey and Dr. Richard Pilliard. In a limited survey, they discover that if one twin was homosexual, the other twin was also homosexual. I can't read the number. 52% of the time, I see, compared with 22% match among non-identical twins. You want to change this line? Thank you. This study does not prove a link between genetics and homosexual orientation. Because think about this. They said 52% of the time for identical twins that if one was homosexual, the other one would be. The fact is, if it was genetic, if it's a matter of genes, what would that percentage be? 100%. 100%. So there is strong evidence also that this study, like almost all the other studies that have been done on trying to prove a genetic link, are flawed because the people that are conducting the studies are homosexual activists themselves. Now, here is a question I'd like to ask. But what if it were true that some people are more prone than others to homosexuality? Would that make it okay? Why not? People are prone to all kinds of things, all kinds of sins in their life. You know, we're not all prone to homosexuality, but we are all possibly prone to something. You know, some people seem more prone than others to lying or to promiscuity or to other things like that. That doesn't mean that that's the way God wants us to be. God did not make us this way. The fall did. So even if they could prove that there was some genetic thing that made someone more prone, that to me would not be an excuse to act on it, any more than if they find out that there's a link to violence genetically, that would excuse someone committing murder. And here's another one. Homosexuals cannot change their orientation. Can a homosexual become straight? This was a full-page ad that was taken out in the New York Times, and these were many former lesbians and gay people saying how that their lives had been changed and that they had accepted Christ and that they were gay no longer. This made the gay community furious, and they sent out all kinds of letters saying, you know, calling these people hateful and calling these groups that back this as being hateful because they merely said that these people had changed. And here's the biblical thing on it. And such were some of you. So according to the Bible, people can definitely change. But I'd like to also mention here, one of the things in our paper they did not long ago, they had a thing on Exodus. It's a group that helps people that come out of homosexuality. And there was some people there that had been formerly involved with Exodus and now had left. And they said that they tried doing it God's way, and they tried to become straight, but it failed them. It didn't work for them, and because they still had the same desires and whatever. You see, what they're doing is they're confusing their temptations with, as if that means they have to do it. For example, there's people that have become Christians and they were alcoholics and maybe they didn't even have problems giving up alcohol after that. And yet there's other Christians that might be alcoholics, become a Christian, and it didn't immediately leave them. It was a struggle for their whole life long. the same could be true for this. And it, and I'm absolutely convinced that it is true for this, that some people will be battling the desires their whole life. But that doesn't mean that it didn't work. That just means that's their cross to bear. That is what they have to struggle with. And it'd be like, you know, you could use all of these arguments involving pedophilia or anything else. You could say, well, you know, I'm geared that way. You know, God made me that way. I've always been that way. And so why shouldn't I be able to do that? And that, of course, is wrong. It's wrong. And they would, many of them would see that. Homosexuals are an oppressed minority that needs special protection. The official Supreme Court criteria for minority status is immutable characteristics such as eye or hair color, skin color, financial discrimination, and political weakness. None of these fit with the homosexual activists, none at all. They can change, as we have seen. They are as wealthy as average, if not more so, and they have extreme political clout. They have extreme political clout. It would be a rare and brave politician that would speak up and say that homosexuality is wrong. We just saw what happened with Jesse White. He was a football player, and he said that homosexuality was wrong, and he lost an ad that he had. He lost work, and he was vilified for it. And you'll always see that with anyone speaks up about homosexuality. Homosexuality, the slippery slope to pedophilia, polygamy, and anything goes. Pedophilia, of course, is having sex with children, for an adult person to have sex with a child. Polygamy, that's having, you know, multiple partners in a marriage. Anything goes, use your imagination, you know. But we're almost there. We are already getting to the point where, well, this is the APA. Some of you, if you ever listened to Dr. Laura, you might have heard she was talking about this last summer. The American Psychological Association recently published a new study opening the way for the normalization of pedophilia. An article in the prestigious Psychological Bulletin proposes that psychologists stop using judgmental terms like child abuse, molestation, and victims, using instead neutral value terms like adult child sex. The authors concluded that behavior which psychotherapists community term abuse may only constitute a violation of social norms. They also propose that pedophilia may only be abuse if the child feels bad about the relationship. They are in effect suggesting repetition of the very steps by which homosexuality was normalized in our culture. Some of you might remember that. That was the first step. The first step was for the psychologist to come out and say that there was really nothing wrong with homosexuality, that it was just another variant, and that it really only broke social norms, and it didn't really, there was nothing really wrong with it unless somebody felt like they were getting hurt about it. Okay, now we're moving on to abortion. Here's their arguments. A woman has a right to choose what she wants to do with her own body, number one. Number two, 5,000 to 10,000 women died annually before abortion was legal. Number three, women are going to get abortions anyway, so we may as well make it safe. Number four, child abuse results from unwanted babies. First thing that I would say is I can't think of any more child abuse than abortion itself, but okay, a woman has a right to choose what she wants to do with her own body. But for the life of me, I can't see that this is a woman's body. This does not look to me like it's a woman's body. A woman does not have rights to do what she wants with her own body. For example, she doesn't have the right to not buckle herself in when she goes for a ride in her car. She does not have the right to, you know, take her hand and slap somebody across the face with it. Everybody's rights end where somebody else's rights begin. And that's what we have here. We have two people. We don't have one person. So she doesn't have a right to decide to kill the child. Okay. here we have another lie that was prevalent. Just like we had with the 10% rule for homosexuality, this was the big lie that got abortion rights going. 5,000 to 10,000 women died annually before abortion was legal. Fact, the U.S. Bureau of Vital Statistics reported that a total of 39 women died from illegal abortions during the 12 months prior to Roe v. Wade in 1973. Just to bring out about the lying aspect again, this is a quote from Bernard Nathanson. He's one of the original leaders of the American pro-abortion movement. He was a co-founder of NARAL, which is the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws, and he's currently pro-life. And he said, how many deaths were we talking about when abortion was illegal? In NARAL, we generally emphasize the drama of the individual case, not the mass statistics. But when we spoke of the latter, it was always 5,000 to 10,000 deaths a year. I confess that I knew the figures were totally false. But in the morality of the revolution, it was a useful figure, widely accepted. So why go out of our way to correct it with honest statistics? That is exactly what that other woman said. It was a nice number. You know, we might have pulled it out of the air, but it was a nice number. And this is where we got to where we are today. And recently, just as a side note, feminists have been caught in another lie, another major lie recently, and that is that a few years ago they said that most of the violence perpetrated against women, most domestic violence, happened on Super Bowl Sunday. So what happened was the hospitals geared up for this extraordinary amount of women that were going to come in being battered on Super Bowl Sunday, and they found out that it was completely false. They went and did they examined the claim and they examined the truth of it, and they realized that it was totally false. Why am I not surprised? I'm not at all surprised, and I wouldn't believe anything that any of these groups were to say unless they could show me the proof of it. So don't just, the lesson is, don't just believe what you hear, what you read in the papers, or what you hear from these sources, because they're just not true. It's just a way of getting what they want to get. Fact, most illegal abortions were performed by licensed physicians in good standing, not by back alley butchers with rusty coat hangers. That's another thing I remember in all the feminist rallies and whatever. What are they carrying around? They're carrying around hangers because they're trying to make the point that women, so many women died because they used to use rusty hangers to go get their abortions. That isn't true. The abortions before Roe v. Wade were performed by, in large measure, by licensed physicians that were just doing it illegally, were just performing it illegally. And legality conferred legitimacy on it. In other words, fewer women considered abortion as an alternative before abortion was legal. Okay, women are going to get abortions anyways. We may as well make it safe. And this is our esteemed president. I want abortions safe and rare. And are they rare? 4,400 daily. 1,606,000 annually. Also, just the idea of this. I want abortion safe and rare. You know, you can illustrate the absurdity by saying, I want to keep gangster killings safe and rare, or I want to keep school shootings safe and rare. You know, that doesn't make sense. Since when do we make murder safe for the murderer? That's the point. It's because they presume that their position is correct in order to say these things, that there's really nothing wrong with abortion. And I ask the question, safe for whom? It's definitely not safe for babies. 38 million children have already died in this Holocaust. Equal rights for unborn women. That's the bumper sticker I want on my car. Equal rights for unborn women. Child abuse results from unwanted babies. This was another one of the things that they said all the time at the beginning. In order to eliminate child abuse, we have to allow abortion because every child should be a wanted child. Well, as I've already said, child abuse, to me, there couldn't be any worse child abuse than abortion in any case. It's horrible abuse. But fact, since the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. Child abuse has gone up. Between 1986 and 1993, child abuse has doubled. And you see how it has skyrocketed in our society, and yet, since it's been legal to get an abortion now since 1973, which is 27 years, any child that is born now would ostensibly be a wanted child, correct? Because if it had not been wanted, they could have done away with it. And yet, so why then is child abuse such a major problem? I think they're tied together, actually. I think we have become a culture of death, and that's why our movies, our popular songs and everything reflect that. Just listen to the lyrics on some of the songs today. It's very sickening. And it also, you know, one irony, too, about this being a so-called women's issue is because look at the way that our culture, our new culture today, our culture of death, degrades women horribly. You know, the movies, they're just all horrible. As a woman, I can't stand to see that. And as a woman who has a grown daughter and who might have grandchildren someday, you know, it's just so horrible to me, the predicament that this whole thing has created. In fact, most abused children are wanted children. I already commented on that. Okay, this is a pro-choice perspective on a person's right to terminate an unwanted abortionist. I am personally opposed to killing abortionists. However, inasmuch as my personal opposition to this practice is rooted in a sectarian Catholic religious belief in the sanctity of human life, I am unwilling to impose it on others who may, as a matter of conscience, take a different view. Of course, I am entirely in favor of policies aimed at removing the root cause of violence against abortionists. Indeed, I would go so far as to support mandatory one-week waiting periods and even non-judgmental counseling for people who are contemplating the choice of killing an abortionist. I believe in policies that reduce the urgent need some people feel to kill abortionists while at the same time respecting the rights of conscience of my fellow citizens who believe that the killing of abortionists is sometimes a tragic necessity, not a good, but a lesser evil. In short, I am moderately pro-choice. This comment comes from Robert P. George. He's a professor of politics, Princeton, first things, December 1994. And now I want to state here for the record that this is not my position. I do not believe in killing anyone. I think that that's totally wrong. I'm sure that the Christian view is be totally wrong to kill anyone. I'm only trying to illustrate the absurdity of this position, and I think that that illustrates it very well. All of a sudden, when it's your life they're talking about, it's not so expendable. Abortion, the slippery slope to euthanasia. Every grandma should be a wanted grandma. I can see that as the mantra of the future. When abortion was legalized, people said it would lead to infanticide, euthanasia. And at the time, I was a young woman, and I believed that I had bought their line, and I believed in abortion. But it turned out that they were absolutely right, weren't they? Those people that said that one thing would lead to another, they were absolutely right. Infanticide is very popularly done today. And also, we are on the way to active euthanasia, I really believe. Okay, here is what some abortion rights advocates have said about infanticide, just to sort of help make the point. Beverly Harriside, infanticide is not a great wrong. I do not want to be construed as condemning women who, under certain circumstances, quietly put their infants to death. And she is Beverly Harrison, Professor of Christian Ethics, Union Theological Seminary in Policy Review, Spring 1985, page 15. This next one is by Margaret Sanger, who you probably realize she was an early feminist, and she also was a founder of Planned Parenthood. And she said, the most merciful thing a large family can do for one of its infant members is to kill it. That would have been me. I'm the fifth of seven. I'm sure that, you know, I would have been gone under that thinking. But also now we have a professor at Princeton. His name is Pete Singer, and he thinks that babies are equivalent to animals. And just as we would kill animals, we should be able to kill small children if it's inconvenient to have them. So euthanasia, these are the arguments for euthanasia. Oh, I see. I forgot about that. I was going to give you the meaning of the word. The word means good or happy death. And there's two kinds. There's a passive, allowing death to occur naturally, or active, taking a life to avoid suffering. The last is not quite as black and white. It's a little bit difficult to see the lines. Okay, here are the arguments now. Euthanasia, first of all, mercifully ends pointless suffering. Second, respects the wishes of the dying. Third, people have a right to die with dignity. And it relieves the financial and emotional burden of the family and society. And I'm sure that you have heard these arguments, you know, because these are the most, common. And it sounds very good, doesn't it? I mean, that's the thing about the leftist agenda, is it sounds compassionate, it sounds caring, and so it's very difficult for people to argue with this unless they have thought it through. Euthanasia mercifully ends pointless suffering. There'd be two counter arguments that I would make. One is, who says suffering is pointless? If you are a Christian, you do not believe suffering is pointless. You believe that God uses suffering for our good, and that it produces emotional growth and spiritual growth. So suffering is not pointless, not pointless at all. And then my second one would be, who says death and suffering? Again, we presume their view in order to say that. We presume that nothing goes on after death. It's presuming their view is true. The Bible does not teach that death is the end of life and consciousness, and so neither do we. Hebrews 9:27 says it's appointed to man once to die, and then the judgment, which only gives the liberal activists another reason to hate us, because we believe in hell, but, you know, we're so mean and everything. Okay, respects the wishes of the dying. Patients in emotional or physical pain are not in a position to make this decision. I don't know if you personally know of anyone that's been disabled or something, and often their first desire is to want to die. They can't imagine life without being able to walk or without being, you know, pain-free or a lot of things like that. And so, you know, you saw that with Christopher Reeve when he was injured in that equestrian accident a few years ago. He wanted to die. He says now that he wanted to die. And yet, he did not die. He went on. His wife made him understand that she loved him for the person that he was. And he went on. And now, I just saw him a couple months ago on the television. They had a clip about these kind of spinal injuries. And he was saying that he's very glad that he did not take his life at that time. So life has a way. The human spirit is repairable, and we human beings have a way of getting up and going on and finding new joy in life, even though we do have to overcome different obstacles. Okay, then we got Dr. Geisler's adage, kill the pain, not the patient. And a lot of times that is what is necessary, is that if people are in great pain, they need to be treated for their pain. Or they may need to be treated for the depression that comes with the injury. And oftentimes when people say they want to die, if you have an elderly parent and they say, I want to die, oftentimes when they would say that, it's a cry for help. What they really would want you to do is say, no, Mom, I wouldn't want you to die. You're not a burden on me. I love you. You know, I mean, that is a lot of times when people say they want to die, they don't really want to die. Okay, euthanasia, people have a right to die with dignity. Okay, a person is not dignified by what he does or what he owns or what he looks like. This is our problem with our American culture, is because we have said that dignity comes from what you have, what you look like, what you do, what your mental capacity is, and all of these kinds of things, and that is totally and completely false. Dignity is something that is conferred on you by God. You're made in the image of God, and you are not dignified by what you look like or whatever. And yet this is a major problem in our culture. Suicide is cowardly, and cowardice is not dignified. Okay. Euthanasia relieves the financial and emotional burden of the family and society. This is the scariest argument to me. This is the scariest argument that they put forth, because there can be no price tag on human life. If you have a right to die, very soon you'll have a responsibility to die. That's what they find in places where, remember I talked about when they came out with abortion, they said there was going to be a slippery slope? Well, there's going to be a slippery slope the same way with euthanasia. I believe that, you know, my generation, I'm a baby boomer, I believe that my generation of baby boomers really started this whole killing spree by killing off their offspring in large numbers, and then by encouraging the offspring that live to go ahead and kill their offspring. And I believe that our generation may be the first to participate in involuntary euthanasia. You know, of course I'm not saying all baby boomers were involved in that by any means, but I'm just saying that the justice for our generation may end up being that we will die at the hands of these utopian idealists. Okay, produces a great burden of guilt on family members, just like abortion does. Abortion, you know, they say that it's guilt-free and that it's not really a human being, but these girls that have abortions know that it is a human being, and so they have to deal with guilt for a long time afterwards. And the same is true with euthanasia. If you put your mother to death, you know, simply because it's inconvenient for you, that's going to produce a mountain of guilt that is not just going to go away. And I want to say one thing before moving on when talking about guilt, and that is that if you know someone that has had an abortion, or if you know someone that has had to make this decision regarding their parents, and you know that they're struggling under a burden of guilt, you might want to reach out to them in love and tell them that there's a forgiveness in God, and that they do not have to live with this guilt, that they can go to God and get forgiveness. Because that is the message of the Christian faith. We're all guilty of things. We're all guilty. I don't look at a homosexual or a person that has gotten an abortion or even activists as being they're evil, they're the black hats, I'm the white hat. No, we're all guilty of things. In fact, one more little side note back about, I forgot to mention about the, when we were back talking about the homosexual thing, is that I've played sports for many years. I'm an athletic person, so I've played softball for years, and then after that I coached, and I've been a bowler and volleyball and all kinds of things. And a female athlete is going to meet up with people that are homosexual. And we had a couple on our team, on our baseball team, for a while. And the rest of the team used to really rip them up when they weren't there. They used to really tear them apart and make fun of them and whatever. And yet, the rest of the team, they were not paragons of virtue. They were sleeping with their boyfriends, or they were living with people, or they, you know, they were not really any better. You know, they were sinners too, just the same way. So one day I came in after the ball game, and they were all sitting there ripping these two up behind their back, and I said, well, there's only one thing worse than sexual sin, and that's ripping apart your teammate when they're not around. And they got really quiet. They got really quiet, and then I gave them my view that if someone is gay, that does not make them worse than the other sinners, you know, that are committing other sins. You know, we should not be categorizing sins. We don't believe as Protestants in venial and mortal sins. We believe sin is sin. So we do not make that type of line. And yet, another thing, when we would talk about it, they liked to hear my views. The girls, even though they were not Christians, they liked to hear my views. And I would encourage you, if you know young people that are not Christians, sometimes they're dying to really hear a good reason for these kind of issues. And so when we would talk about these things, there was one other girl on the team that was a Christian, but she would let me do all the talking. And they would ask me about these things, and we would discuss it. And then it's interesting to me how that, even though they would tear down these girls all the time, these two girls that were gay, yet when I would give them my viewpoint that homosexuality was wrong and that it was a sin, then they would accuse me of being a bigot. So in other words, they were the ones that were mean, but I was the bigot because I believed that homosexuality is wrong as a practice. So then I would have to give them other arguments, like one of the girls had a baby. And I said to her, well, what would you do if somebody kidnapped your baby and had sexual relations with that child? Oh, I'd kill him. You know, but why? Why would you? What if that's how God made them? You know, what if that's the way that they feel fulfilled, is to have sex with children, you know? And they can see that. They can really see that. So I would really encourage you to talk to people about these issues when you get an opportunity, and do so in love. If they know you love them, a lot of times they really do want to hear what you have to say. Okay, the right to die soon becomes a responsibility to die. I said that. This is something I just took out of our paper at home. It was a study exposes America's lengthy use of eugenics, and it goes back to the early days of eugenics, which I don't know if you know this, but the founders of Planned Parenthood and a lot of these utopian schemers were eugenics. Margaret Sanger, for example, was a eugenic, believed in eugenics. I don't know how many of you know what that is, but it's based on Darwinism, and it's the study of correcting human problems. You find out that people have genetic traits, you know, maybe they're criminal by nature, or maybe they're feeble-minded. They didn't want them to pass down those traits, so they thought, we'll help evolution along, and we'll sterilize these people. And that is exactly what they did, even in this country. Of course, they were doing that in Germany, too. But a lot of Americans don't know that that happened here. And that is the same people who are now involved with Planned Parenthood. American doctors who once believed sterilization could help rid society of mental illness and crime launched a 20th century eugenics movement that in some ways paralleled the policies of Nazi Germany, researchers said Monday. Sterilization laws had authorized the neutering of more than 40,000 people classed as insane or feeble-minded in 30 states by 1944. Another 22,000 underwent sterilization from the mid-40s to 1963, despite weakening public support and revelations of Nazi atrocities. The comparative histories of the eugenical sterilization campaigns in the United States and Nazi Germany reveal important similarities of motivation, intent, and strategy. The study's authors wrote in the Annals of Internal Medicine, a journal published by the American College of Physicians, American Society of Internal Medicine. Eugenics sprang from the philosophy of social Darwinism, which envisioned human society in terms of natural selection and suggested science could engineer progress by attacking supposedly hereditary problems, including moral decadence, crime, venereal disease, tuberculosis, and alcoholism. So it was the same thing. They were gonna, you know, these people's lives were not worth living. These people were inferior. So let's do away with them. It's the whole utopian liberal idea of let's create a better society. You know, these people, you know, one of the ways they defend euthanasia we talked about was that they say it's going to be so costly. And it is. You know, so they'll say, well, why should we bear the brunt of these costs? Why should we bear the brunt of costs of an aging society? And yet that was exactly what started off the Holocaust in Nazi Germany, was euthanasia. People don't realize that. They do not realize that it started that way, first with sterilization and abortion, and then with euthanasia. And here we go with the slippery slope again. Every person should be a wanted person, the slippery slope to genocide.
In late 1938 or early 1939, one random letter which Buhler's office showed to Hitler had a devastating effect. It was from the father of a mentally disabled child who asked the Führer's permission to have the child killed. Hitler agreed. He had already ordered the sterilization of the disabled. This one letter would now be the catalyst to their murder. Manfred Bernhardt and the others were murdered because they weren't wanted in the Nazis' perfect state. The catalyst that caused his death was that random letter to Hitler on a subject close to his heart, brought to his attention by an ambitious underling. The euthanasia program officially went into effect in late 1939. Nazi leaders issued orders to kill anyone with a serious physical deformity or mental illness. In their words, anyone considered to have a life unworthy of living. Thousands were put to death, but it was only a hint of what was coming.
That's something that a lot of Americans do not realize. I've been told I show this at youth groups that are at our boot camp, and some people have objected to me going through this presentation and showing that because it's so horrible. And I agree. I agree it's horrible. And yet, after the Nazi Holocaust and World War II, the German people claimed that they didn't know what was going on. And they actually took them out to the camps and showed them the bodies and showed them what was going on. Because we need to know what is going on in our society. It's important to know. Do I enjoy that? No, I hate that. That to me is horrible. But we're left with, you know, if we're not going to show this to our children, I think that they are the only hope to maybe reverse this. I know with my daughter, I taught her these things when she was in high school, and sometimes she would be the only one in a class. They would have debates about different things, and sometimes she would debate for the pro-life side, and she would be totally outnumbered, because even if there were other pro-life people, sometimes they wouldn't have the courage to speak out. But you know what? She changed some minds. She did change some minds, and I think that we can't afford not to let the younger generation know these things and not to get them interested in seeing if they can solve it or seeing if they can have something to do with clearing up the lies. Because as we've seen, this whole thing is based on lies. And there will be a new lie every day that are going to back these kind of issues, because that's the way it works. We'll take a little lie, get people, you know, feeling that this is the right thing to do, this is the compassionate thing to do, and it'll end up being something absolutely horrible that nobody wanted and that nobody expected to happen. Am I saying that something like Nazi Germany will happen, that we will, you know, lead to that? I really don't know. I really don't know. I'm not a prophet. I wouldn't say that would happen. I do know that the time was ripe in Nazi Germany for that to happen. And the statements, I've read a lot of books on that, and the statements made, though, by the doctors, the Nazi Holocaust was begun by doctors and intellectuals. I don't know if most people know that. But the statements they made was that they thought that this was a good thing, that they were doing therapy in killing these children that were disabled or mentally unhealthy. They thought that they were doing right. And so we look at the Nazis and we think, well, they're animals. You know, they're something. They're totally subhuman in our thinking, that they could have done such a thing. And could it happen here? I think it could. I think it could. Yes.
I have a question.
Sure.
I think that's great that she brought up your daughter that way, and that she's being a witness now for God and for life. Okay. My question to leaders like yourself is, and I want to hear your reflection. What can we, as adult, responsible Christian American citizens, and I know prayer is the bottom line. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we can. I mean, I know we can vote. I know we can work for people who say that they're pro-life or whatever, but I don't think our hope can be in politicians or politics. Okay, the question is, what should we do as American Christians? What can we do? How can we get our lawmakers to see things our way and to stop the Holocaust that's going on? And I'm responding by saying, I don't know if we can. I don't think that we can hope in politicians or hope in it. I do believe in voting. I do believe in doing what we can do. I believe in prayer, like you said. And I also believe in writing to your newspaper, influencing your circle of people, influencing the people that are in your life. I write to the newspapers. And you know what? They always publish them. They always publish my letters, you know, and I could write every single day. I mean, that's how many things are in the paper that I could respond. Yes, sure, he'd like to respond too. This is my husband. This is Don Vino. He wants to get his 2 cents.
I got to get my 2 cents in. Don't walk too far away. Why don't you take that off a second? We'll pass it back and forth. Okay. I touched partly on that in my workshop yesterday. One of the problems that we have today as a Christian community is we actually live in this kind of little ghetto where we hide from culture, and we really need to have Christian intellectuals, Christian politicians, people who are born, raised in Christian belief or have become Christians from outside, who are taught how to think and how to articulate an intelligent argument. I mean, for example, picketing an abortion clinic is not necessarily a bad thing, but does it really change the thought processes of non-believers? I would suggest it does not. It further alienates them from thinking about the issue, because Middle America, as Dr. Norman Geiser points out, is Middle America because they live in the middle. They don't live on the right and they don't live on the left. And when a pro-life group blows up an abortion clinic, what happens? Middle America shifts to the left. Not because they agree with them, but because they don't want to be perceived as radical on the right. When someone on the left does something radical, guess what? Middle America shifts to the right. Not because they hold our values necessarily, but because they don't want to be radical. So we need more churches like Calvary Chapel who's saying, here's what the scripture says, here's how we can intelligently articulate that, and challenge the ideas. It can be done. It's going to be hard. You know, I don't know if you realize this. Has anyone heard of Justin Martyr, second century apologist? Do you realize his first apology was a political statement? He wrote to Congress because they were persecuting Christians because of their Christian beliefs. And he said, wait a minute, you're persecuting us for taking communion because you say we're drinking blood. We don't really drink blood, but there are groups that do drink blood and you don't persecute them. You're persecuting us because, and he went down each of these things. And his conclusion was, and he sent this to all the senators, you're afraid everyone's going to become a Christian and you won't have a job anymore.
One more thing I'd like to comment on what you said, and that is that we are called to be faithful, and we're not called to necessarily, we don't know whether Christian ideals will succeed in our country. It seems like this is a post-Christian culture right now. And I think my friend Bill Honsberger says all the time that we're living right now still with this Christian, we're basking in this Christian afterglow of, kind, you know, that it's right to be kind to people or whatever. But it doesn't mean that the next generation will even remember a lot of these same things. And so I think we're not called to be successful. We're called to be, for our generation, that beacon, and to stand up for righteousness in our generation and in our time. And if we have to suffer for it or suffer persecution even, I know in Nazi Germany, they could not turn it around. There was Christians there that saw what was happening, and they could not turn it around. A lot of them went to the camps and died. And we consider them martyrs for the faith at this time. Will that happen here? I don't know. I'm not trying to say that that will. I'm not advocating fear about these things. I'm just saying we need to stand up and do what's right, regardless of the outcome. Yes?
Yes, I
Okay, this lady is rightly pointing out that Darwinism is behind a lot of this, a lot of these issues. I agree 1,000%, and she also made the point that it was women that brought Hitler to power. And I would say, I don't know how many women are into the radical feminism. I would suggest that there is a lot, but I would suggest that most women are not radical feminists. You know, maybe they believe in equal pay or something like that. But the radical feminists are the ones that the media goes to. and talks to them, and so the people who believe as I do don't really get our views out. Yes. Right. Even the people that strongly believe in abortion know that that is not true, know that it is a lot more than tissue, or they would not say that they want abortions to be rare, and they wouldn't feel so uncomfortable about the procedure as they did. This was one of the letters that I wrote to our paper. Is, I don't know if you guys know Ellen Goodman, but she did an article on that saying that it was tissue or whatever, and I said, no, she knows, because she was also saying she wished abortion was rare. And I'd say, why? You know, who goes around saying they wish tonsillectomies were rare? Or they wish, you know, I mean, that's a nonsensical statement if there's nothing wrong with abortion. Yes.
A couple things. You mentioned, you know, about a post-Christian time we're in. And I think it's more of an anti-Christian time than post-Christian, because all the views are against Christianity or anyone who is a Christian. And to me, that's more anti than post-Christian. And also, the issue on abortion, I find that when I talk to people about abortion, most of them don't really know what abortion entails, especially partial birth abortion. And when you tell them about it, they're horrified. Mm-hmm. And I think that word needs to get out more. And another thing, too, I've watching like the what was it, the Mars probe, it amazes me, and I mentioned this to a couple friends of mine now. They go out looking for what they call life on other planets, and it can be microscopic life, you know, and they'll call it life. But yet they won't call a fetus life.
That is an excellent point. And, yes, I do think we're living in an anti-Christian culture, but I think that part of the reason is because they're reacting against, you know, it's a rebellion against the culture that used to be. And I don't think that they really know what culture will be like when all vestige of Christianity disappears, if that should happen. I think they would have no clue as to how horrible culture would be without the influence of Christian people. Who else? Yes. I'm going to let you get that
page. Can I do a Darth Vader in here?
No, I'm just kidding. Back to the whole idea of, you know, the next generation, what are we going to do for, you know, our children? And the whole idea of evolution and creationism, that whole concept there, you know, a lot in classrooms right now, in many circles in education, you have a lot of evolution being taught. Now, how do we find, I mean, like right here in our own bookstore, there's some incredible literature that support creationism based on factual evidence. And, of course, you go with the evolution theories. No, there's all kinds of, you know, evidence here that supports evolution, so we must teach evolution. How do we incorporate, okay, more of the creationism, more of these types of literature, more of these types of books into the classroom where the student has a choice to, you know, if evolution is going to be there, evolution is going to be there, okay? And if they're going to have literature and, you know, and information to use as resources, fine. You know, they're going to be there. We know that. But how do we get the books that they need to get, the tools necessary to make their decisions? You follow what I'm saying? How do we get those types of that type of information into their hands?
We may not be able to get back into the public schools. It's what this lady asked me. It's a variation on that theme. How are we going to win the battle? How are we going to take back the schools? How are we going to take back our country? I don't necessarily think we're going to be able to do that. We can do absolutely as much as we can to educate ourselves and everybody we know. We can do what we can to get these books and things into the hands of our children. Our ministry does something called a Young Defenders Boot Camp, where we are going around the country and teaching young people how to answer the cults, how to answer the cultural arguments. We feel that, to us, we got into this ministry because we wanted to answer cults, but then we found out it's the culture. Culture is a large part of the problem, even with the cult. So that's my answer. Yes, one more.
My school teaches evolution, and one of the ways we can bring it in is maybe like contradicting or bringing evidence up in class, because I try to do that sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you can also try to bring books to class and just like tell the students, like, they can look for themselves and see the evidences for each side.
Thank you very much. I got to quit, but we can talk afterwards. But one thing I wanted to say just before I quit is that I do have some hope for this generation. I do think that this generation wants to know what's true and they want to know what's right. I think with any luck at all, maybe they'll rebel against us the way we rebelled against our parents, and we're hoping that that will happen.
I want to say one other thing, and then we'll quit. Relative to this question, it's an important question. How do we get it back in? We do have some really intelligent creationists. Not all of them are Christians. And they are really challenging the Darwinian community in a major way right now. It's a group called The Wedge, which is made up of Dr. Philip Johnson, Michael Behe, a guy named Verlinski. Several of them are out there producing good scholarly literature supporting a creation view. We need to promote that. There's two questions that come down to. One is, what do you really believe, and how much are you willing to invest in that belief? Mm-hmm. You'll find liberals really believe what they say they believe, and they are willing to put time and money and finance organizations to promote their agenda. We don't have that really in the Christian community very much. Groups like ours and Philip Johnson's and others struggle just to put out a newsletter every month. Because Christian community just is not really, we don't want to make waves. But if we're going to change culture, we have to challenge culture, and that comes by being out there, being visible, being financed, producing high-quality information that non-believers can look at and go, you know, I never thought about it. This is a good response to what I've believed. Let me not necessarily agree with it, but at least give it equal hearing. Does that make sense? One last thing, we got to quit. Perfect. Great books, yeah. Correct. But if there's a particular way it has to be done, and these groups today are doing, and that's what I said earlier, good thinkers who can lay out a good argument, give good scientific evidence for the view, and I think it's possible to change. Like Joy said, we can't predict anything. But in large part, it's going to depend on how the church really responds to it. We have two choices. We can hide in the foxhole, as we've done for the last 60 years, or we can get out there and challenge culture. Yes? The idol is money.
But it's also personal autonomy and things like that.
Right. It was the money. Okay. All right, we're going to have to end, so then get ready for the next session, but thank you.
Thank you very much.